From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Over the first weekend of 2016, federal immigration agents raided homes in Texas, Georgia, and here in North Carolina. They detained people thought to be illegal immigrants, primarily from Central America. The raids have prompted an outcry from Hispanic and Latino advocacy groups and a letter signed by 130 congressional Democrats calling for an end to the raids. During his final State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called once more for immigration reform and criticized anti-immigrant rhetoric among Republican presidential candidates. The president made no mention of the recent raids. In the GOP response to the State of the Union, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley attempted to change the tone of the national conversation. As the daughter of Indian immigrants who lived in the rural South, she says she knows what it's like to not look like one's neighbors.
My story is really not much different from millions of other Americans. Immigrants have been coming to our shores for generations to live the dream that is America. They wanted better for their children than for themselves. That remains the dream of all of us. And in this country, we have seen time and again that that dream is achievable. Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation. No one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country.
According to the last U.S. Census, Hispanic people make up 9% of the population in North Carolina. And today we're going to learn more about our local immigrant population, who they are and where they come from, the challenges they face assimilating, and how the recent anti-immigrant sentiment might be manifesting itself here. With us in the studio today is Dr. Edelmira Segovia. She is the director of Centro Hispano at UNCW, part of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. Dr. Segovia, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today, Helen Tarokic, a North Carolina board-certified immigration law specialist. Helen Tarokic, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Did you come here from another country? Are you glad you came, or do you have regrets? Tell us about your experience here by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Helen Tarokic, if you're from Central America, living here now in southeastern North Carolina, what is the climate like? How is that conversation happening among people from that part of the world? How have the recent raids affected the conversation here?
Well, as often happens when there are raids, we have families calling our office constantly asking, what should they do? Many of our callers are people who have pending immigration cases and are existing clients. Many of them are people who already have their immigration status issues resolved, and yet they still are living in fear. They're afraid for what may happen if there may be changes in laws that would take them away from their families, and they're also afraid of what's going to happen to their friends and their neighbors or their parents.
Is it true that there's been fear to talk about internment camps and people are actually afraid of that here?
Yes, and I think with some of the rhetoric of Donald Trump that we're not far from that if he were to really move into a place of power within the country. I mean, he's already decided that he wants to have a list of immigrants and particularly Muslims. The building of walls, the separating of people, those are in line with things that we saw with Hitler's regime during World War II, and we're not that many decades away from it in our American history for what we did with the Japanese. And I think that enough fear and emotional terror could result in something like that again in the future. And I'm not a doomsday person, but I don't think that we are necessarily that far away from something like that happening if the wrong people are put into power.
Well, let's talk about who this local immigrant population is. I've been referring to it as a population of immigrants, but Edelmira Segovia, we talked right before we came on the air about the difference between the terms Hispanic and Latino. Where are most of these people who come from other countries and who are living here in the Cape Fear region? Where are they from?
Well, we have a large population from the Mexican region. That continues to be a national trend. Because we are North Carolina, an agricultural state, a lot of our Mexican nationals also are from agricultural regions in Mexico. We have a large population of individuals from the state of Oaxaca, for example. This is a population that has its roots in agriculture. And also it's roots in a different language. They have their own language. So this population is actually learning Spanish as a second language and English as a third. Let's go back to the note that we are an agricultural state. However, that agriculture business is also changing. So the original immigrants that came here to actually do hand labor and pick our crops by hand have now settled here, and our own agriculture continues to progress. So we are looking now at a population that maybe settled here, let's say 20, 25 years back. Now we are seeing the children of those immigrants who are, I would argue, the majority of our Latino population, Hispanic population here in the state of North Carolina is very much a youthful, very much a K-12 or maybe even a college age group. Very much getting away from the field of agriculture now into other industries. Tourism, North Carolina is very well known for that. Other industries, as we are a state that the nation is definitely looking at us for progress and growth in terms of industry, businesses, and expansion.
And you're starting to see more of the children come to UNCW.
Absolutely. And I have a background in public education, and back when I was in the public school system, I refer to this as the tsunami. This is a tsunami of Hispanic Latino individuals who are making North Carolina their home. Part of that is we have very family-oriented, I feel, cities, towns, and a school system. So these students are now in our public school system. We have schools that are up of 50% plus Hispanic Latino, and we are starting to see that at the college level so much so that in the last five or so years that I've been at the college, we have seen just about double the population of our Latino Hispanic students on campus.
And you say Hispanic Latino, Latino Hispanic. So let's, for our listeners' sake and for my sake,
sure,
let's talk about the difference between those terms.
I think it's very much a personal opinion that can also be argued and based on some of the history and some of the language. Let's say the term Hispanic, that is definitely referring to our to our Spanish language and that history behind us being conquered and eventually giving independence from Spain. So all of the countries that have that the mother tongue as Spanish, I think, are going to very much lean towards identifying themselves as Hispanic. Obviously, Spanish, the Spaniards from Spain are going to identify themselves as Hispanic as well. Now let's go to South America. This is Latino America, Latin America, Brazil happens to be part of that group. However, they are not Spanish speakers. So while they may identify themselves as Latino or Latin Americans, they will never identify themselves as Hispanic simply because, well, let's go back to history. The lines were drawn. Portugal drew the line on that end, and Spain drew the line on this end. So, but depending on where you're from, one could be used for the other. One thing that I must say is that for any immigrant who is coming into this country, we would have never identified ourselves as either one prior to coming to this country. It is not until you land in U.S. soil that the U.S. Census asks you to check a box. We will always be identified as the national origin. I am Peruvian. You are Cuban. You are Mexican. It is not until we are lumped together in this nation and asked to check a box that it dawns on you and you begin to, by force, identify yourself as one or the other, Hispanic, Latino.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Ellen Tarakic, can you talk about who some of your clients are and the kinds of challenges that they're facing right now in this area?
For confidentiality reasons, of course, we don't talk about individual cases or ones with details that would be identified. But I think that what I see in my office is a vast diversity of cases, which for me is very exciting. We have a lot of minors who are coming in from the United States using the refugee program. We have folks who are fleeing domestic violence from Central America and from other countries who are seeking refuge in the United States. I also have a very strong business immigration practice. So we've been working on investor cases, people who are investing from outside countries to create American jobs. And we've got two alien of extraordinary ability cases to be filed this month for individuals who've risen to the top 5% of their field in the world and are internationally recognized. So we're dealing with folks who come in to do tech jobs and people who are really fleeing uncontrollable violence and people who need humanitarian protection all in the same day on a regular basis. It's very diverse law practice.
And so when you talk about some of the people fleeing Central America because of domestic violence, are you talking about the gang violence there?
Sometimes there is a nexus between domestic violence and gang violence, and sometimes those are quite separate issues. So in particular, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador have been experiencing rising levels of violence that have gotten to the point where people cannot live an everyday life anymore, even people who are in the middle or upper middle class. And oftentimes, personal relationships develop, and then that turns into a gang issue as well.
And we'll talk more about that. We're just about to go to the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about immigration reform with Helen Tarakic, an immigration law specialist, and Edelmira Segovia, director of Centro Hispano at UNCW. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 910-343-1138. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio today, Edelmira Segovia, director of UNCW Centro Hispano, and Helen Tarakic, a North Carolina board-certified immigration law specialist. If you'd like to ask our guests a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline or at whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. And we have a caller, John from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, I'll try to keep this short. I immigrated legally to the U.S. in 73.
Mm-hmm.
I had a medical degree. I had
to. And John, can I ask where you came from?
Originally from England, but I came in through Canada this time.
Mm-hmm.
I had a job waiting for me in the U.S. I had to have a letter of approval from the Department of Labor. I wouldn't be taking a job away from an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
I had physicals, chest x-rays. I had an interview with the U.S. Embassy. I was fingerprinted and the print sent to the RCMP, who sent a copy to the FBI saying I had no record.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewed, I immigrated. I had to register every January that I had a job and where I was living at the time. And at that period, I even had to register for the draft after being in the U.S. for 6 months. And I know there's a tremendous number of individuals like myself who are going through all the hoops, doing everything legally, and deeply troubled by carte blanche attitude that, well, you know, you snuck in, we're going to just go ahead and give you citizenship and all the benefits thereof, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting perspective, John. Helen Tarakic, what would you say to that? He used the term carte blanche.
Yes. If I may first just say that the process that John went through is not that much different today, only the waiting periods are increased to about 6 to 12 years before you can actually get across. So it's very, very thorough on the business immigration end of things, and I congratulate you for getting through those steps. I think there is an emotional concern about the carte blanche. The problem that I see is that that's the perception in the media and on a few ad hoc cases, but what we actually go through with the individuals who are seeking, for example, special immigrant juvenile status or asylum, is that they are also going through things like intensive medical exams, tuberculosis tests, checks, x-rays, long interviews, multiple court proceedings, trials, more than one court may be involved. The process may take years to be resolved. In some cases, we can get it done in 6 to 12 months. Those are sort of the miracle cases. So there's this whole process that happens, and I think that our media and our government really hasn't informed the public enough about it, and it does create fear. And I remember when I moved from my business immigration practice, which was more cases like John's, into humanitarian work, only to find out, wow, there's this whole universe that exists out there of procedures and protocols that we all need to follow. And that system exists. It's just that there's a lot of abuse in the system, not necessarily by applicants, but we actually see government officials turning people away or misinforming them of the process. And then they sort of get stuck in this logjam, and then that's where the problem, that's where people start falling out of status or missing court occurs.
My experience has been, being in the medical field, I had to deal with translators because we had a tremendous number of Hispanic patients come in, and apparently the employer has to provide, or the government has to provide, a translator for them. And the translators admitted to me, quite honestly, the preponderance of them were illegals. They just crossed over the border.
The majority of your patients, John, were not legally here. That's what you're saying.
Exactly, yes.
John, how do you know that?
It wasn't uncommon for them to bring narcotics over with them. This is from Hispanic translators. They were true blue themselves. It's not uncommon for them to bring narcotics with them to get a head start in the U.S.
What are the statistics at this point, either Edelmira Segovia or Helen Tarakic? What do you know at this point about the number of people who are undocumented immigrants in the United States? Do we have a grasp of that?
Our estimate is about 12 million, and honestly, I personally think about half of them could be cases that could be resolved if we have the proper procedures in place and actually give people the information that they need.
And by resolved, what do you mean?
Where those people would be ultimately able to obtain immigration status or finally see their cases come to conclusion.
How do people arrive here illegally? How does that happen? Because right now, I think there's this perception that people are running across the border, or they're digging tunnels and coming through tunnels, and, you know, they're openly, brazenly trying to permeate the country's borders. And, you know, there's all this talk of border control, and it's a national security issue on the borders. But do you think that that's where the majority of these undocumented people are coming from? Are they coming across the border? Is that how they're here? How does it happen? What are some of the more complicated circumstances that you've seen in your practice?
Such a great question. We have our most unsecure border is actually the border between the United States and Canada. And I think that one of the largest groups of individuals making a false claim to U.S. citizenship and stealing identities are actually white Canadians. That obviously wasn't John's circumstance. And I think that it's hard to detect when you don't have an ability to look at someone and maybe by their accent or a tan have the idea that maybe you should be asking more questions. So that's one thing. We do have people coming across the border. The biggest misperception that I think people fall into is that they don't understand that even if somebody walks across our border, and I often call it stumbling, you're trying to enter the United States to seek refuge and protection, but it's not like when you are getting from that Mexican border into the United States that there's some wonderful path or people to guide you or to help you get to the point where you can ask for refuge. And so they just come across and often turn themselves directly into immigration agents. So that is still entering in an undocumented, unlawful fashion. And yet, by the time they turn themselves in, they're supposed to have a process. Unfortunately, oftentimes they're just turned around. There's a lot of incidents of abuse. We have a class action lawsuit, number of lawsuits pending against Custom and Border Protection for abuse along the border, including sexual abuse of immigrants and their children. So there are other ways, not to give anybody any ideas, but we do see people coming in with visas and just overstaying. So they've obtained a visa outside the United States, and then they get here and they break the rules. Folks who don't need a visa to come into the United States, who are typically part of the visa waiver program, tend to be from countries that have a very low rate of visa fraud or visa overstays. So, for example, folks coming in on ESTA from the United Kingdom, or Americans, where almost ever we go in the world, we don't need a visa to walk in, or we're given a visa when we get through the immigration point just on arrival to that country because they assume we're going to go back to our country. So people still may come in on that program to the United States and then choose to overstay. And then, you know, there's boats and ports, and other people use in the Indian culture, the humsuckle visa. It's like a lookalike visa where they've obtained papers, real papers, but that's not the person that they pertain to. And so they present these papers and the border official or the airport officer most likely can't tell that this person is not the person on the visa.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about immigration reform, how the national conversation relates to our local population of people who were born in other countries. If you'd like to ask a question of our guests, we have Helen Tarakich, who is a North Carolina board-certified immigration law specialist, and Dr. Edelmira Segovia, who is director of Centro Hispano at UNCW. Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And John, thanks very much for that call. We have an email from Anne. She says, I work with folks from Spain, some living in Spain, others in other European countries, and they do not identify themselves as Hispanic. And at least one is offended by the word. We've had these conversations because it's data we often collect. I think Hispanic relates more to the new world than the old world. Edelmira Segovia, is that something that you've heard before?
Sure. I think that we go back to how the conversation started. I think it's something very personal. And depending on the region of the person, their take on things, that is going to be a very individualized answer. From one individual to the other, you're going to have a whole range of reasons why they may identify as one or the other or none of them.
And as part of your work at Centro Hispano, can you describe what that organization does as part of UNCW's Office of Diversity and Inclusion?
Absolutely. Well, our mission is to support the fast-growing number of students applying, enrolling, and completing degrees at the university. It is a center that is now completing its 10th year in the making. It started as an idea, realizing that there's a few Hispanics coming on board, a little more next year and a little more next year. We had our founding director, Dr. Antonio Puente, who continues to be at the college, now actually the upcoming president of the American Psychological Association, who was simply assigned the task of being the everything and anything related to Hispanic relations. You be the person, the point guard. Eventually, we were giving a little space here and then another little space here. And now we are actually in the student union. We have our main role is to support, again, the fast-growing number of applicants and students who are completing degrees, keeping in mind that this is a population that is largely first-generation college-bound in the States.
And why does this population need support? Why does there have to be an office to support this population?
It largely comes from being, again, a first-generation college-bound family. It is they're families that are not brought up in the culture of college. I would assume that the three of us around here maybe were schooled in that or had the opportunity at some point to learn the ropes of having a higher education. A lot of these students are coming in as themselves having to, by sometimes just by test and trial, trying to figure out how can they continue their education. So we do a lot of tying up loose ends. We do a lot of education. We go out into the community. We have had tremendous support from our campus partners, both from the Office of Admissions, Student Affairs, Housing, et cetera, to get the students, once they are having identified as being eligible to study at our college, keep in mind that we are a selective university. We continue to make national rankings left and right. So once they've identified as being a true candidate to be a student at our campus, then it's up to the campus, all of us with the support of Centro Hispano, supporting the students so that housing, financial aid, all of these pieces, classes are lined up so that the student can actually begin, and not only begin, but actually complete the degree with us. Keeping in mind that 9 out of 10, these students are doing this on their own with the emotional support of the family, but not so much with that college of culture of college support.
Sure, not having that body of experience
Absolutely.
To go along with it. Are there students at UNCW who would be considered undocumented?
Yes, we would have students who are considered undocumented. However, we are under the government of, you know, we are a UNC institution. So we have our general administration governing our policy. And the UNC policy is very, very clear in that we are, we accept students based on academic merit. So every student that comes on board must have every requirement as far as the courses go, as far as the SAT or the ACT, leadership, et cetera. Now, the difference comes when it's time to pay for tuition. When it comes time to pay for tuition, a student who may be undocumented or that does not have legal status in the country is not going to be approved for North Carolina residency for the tuition cost.
So that alone could knock a potential student out of becoming a member of the UNCW student body.
Absolutely, because the student who is undocumented would not be eligible for federal or state financial aid. So this student would be leaning on private scholarships or out of pocket, and we're looking at more than double the cost of in-state tuition. So for a student, for tuition and fees alone, you may be looking at $20,000 out of pocket if you do not have legal residency or citizenship.
We have an email from George who writes, I'm a student at UNCW who's worked with high school students who have arrived here illegally and are now finding issues with extremely high tuition and lack of financial support academically because they're illegal, what you were just talking mm-hmm. about, Dr. Segovia. What kinds of resources would be available for them, and are there any types of changes being made on a state level for these students?
Let's look at our state level as far as higher ed. We have our UNC system, right? All of the sister institutions that are under that wing. We have our community college system, which is separate, totally different policies. And then we have the third, which is our private schools, which are going to charge tuition. No matter who you are, you will pay the same tuition. So to answer George's question, right now, the North Carolina Community College system has been the most proactive, ironically, because they were the most, let's say, they had the strongest policies against undocumented back a few years past. Now, they are allowing students to enroll with them. Let's keep in mind that the community college cost is much lower than the four-year university cost. But not only that, they also have a policy in place that is open to any North Carolina employer to support their employee with their higher education, with their college.
Helping to pay for that?
They do have the option. Let's say any North Carolina employer can actually sponsor their employee. It would have to be a direct company to university, a check written out directly from that institution to the college in support of their employee at the in-state tuition rate. So that is up to, obviously, that company, whether they see value in this employee and they want to retain them Obviously, that is something that the institution can do. Another route to answer George's question, if this student happens to continue to be in high school, this student, as a high school student, could also tap onto the early college system that is a public high school like any other one. Obviously, you have to go through eligibility requirements. It is a competitive event. But it would allow this student to earn up to the equivalent or an actual associate's degree as a high school student. Another option would be within the regular high school, if the student is advanced enough to actually enroll as a dual student, high school and college student at the same time, that student may have access, again, to the community college classes at no cost while he or she remains a K-12 student. Again, we have compulsory education up to age 16 and then free public education up to age 21.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about immigration reform, some of the challenges that immigrants, both documented and not, face, especially in this region. And we're going to go to break in about a minute and a half. But Helen Tadokic, one of the things, we've used the term undocumented and we've used the term illegal. Can you just sort of explain briefly the difference between those terms and what they mean? It's not just semantics.
I think that the best way to say it is that no human being is illegal. Actions can be unlawful. I think the word illegal, it is a word. It has connotations of bad and evil activity. And a lot of times people have issues with immigration status that has nothing to do with their intentions being good or bad. And so I use the word undocumented often because it's really a matter of getting the documentation in order for somebody to have lawful presence or lawful status. The other thing is that some people have valid status and or even American citizens and don't have the documentation to prove it.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Helen Tadokic, an immigration law specialist, and Edelmira Segovia from UNCW Centro Hispano about the national conversation on immigration reform. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Edelmira Segovia of UNCW Centro Hispano, part of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and Helen Tadokic, an immigration law specialist. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment about the challenges you face as a new resident of the United States, or you'd just like to ask our guests a question or log your comment, your window of opportunity is closing. We have one segment left, so give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at coastlinehqr. And Helen Tadokic, Edelmira Segovia talked about some of the ways that students, undocumented students, can get help paying for college. And you can talk about some of the ways that people can get documentation. Tell us about that.
I think that one of the things that we always try to focus on is getting people in early and often, because changes in the law happen so quickly and changes in policy happen so quickly that you can truly miss the boat at your chance at becoming somebody with lawful status or lawful permanent residence or even becoming an American if you don't seek the benefit on time. I want to just give an overview of one type of case that comes into our office. There are hundreds of different types of immigration categories, but this one is called the U visa, and it's for victims of crime. And the original congressional intent was that we want people to be able to be good Samaritans and to report and detect crime and to work with prosecutors and the police so that people are safe, in particular, from violent crime. And so the idea was, if you call 911 and you've been a victim of crime, and in some cases also just a witness, you should be able to get certified by a law enforcement agency. This could be the police, the sheriff, the prosecutor, a judge, sometimes the Department of Social Services, sometimes the Department of Labor. And once getting a certification form confirming that you were a victim and cooperated in this detection or investigation of the crime, you should be able to move on to the next step, which would be applying with immigration. And so these laws were passed, and years went by, and these regulations and forms were not issued to actually be able to apply. So what happened was we were sending one message that said, work with us, and the other message said, there may be no protection for you. And a lot of people weren't told about it at all, and we still have people coming into our office for their first-time consultation learning that, wow, there's this option they've never, ever heard of. They had no idea that this was going to be the basis of their immigration status until they met me or one of my staff members. So what happens in the very beginning is they hear through someone or decide to call us for a consultation. That consultation is not your typical consultation. It may last 1 to 2 hours in the first session, and I often bring people back for another hour or two to talk more about the risks and the benefits of applying and all of the things that they would need to do. Earlier on in the program, a gentleman mentioned how many steps that he went through, and the steps are very comprehensive for this type of application as well. The certification program for victims of crime, preparing an application to be certified may take months. It may require psychological evaluations, obtaining 911 records, police incident reports, statements from other witnesses, medical records, and other supporting documentation. And then that submission, if it goes to, for example, the Wilmington Police, we may be waiting upwards of a year for an answer. And then if it goes to the local district's attorney's office, they actually have a really nice, quick turnaround. But I think a lot of that depends on the number of people who are requesting assistance. If the person is certified as helpful at that point, it may take us anywhere from 30 days to 5 months to prepare an application to file with immigration. Once that application is submitted, about 3 weeks later, they would get receipt notices, and a few weeks later, they'd be receiving an appointment to go for biometrics, which is a photograph, height, weight, and fingerprinting background check system that happens. For people in Wilmington, they would go to the immigration office in Durham. And then once those biometrics are completed, they're good for 15 months. So if a case takes longer than that, they may be asked to come back in and be re-fingerprinted. The process may take now about 20 months to get a decision from immigration, only to be told that there are more than 10,000 applicants and there's only 10,000 visas. So
if I'm waiting for this kind of decision and the decision comes back that for whatever reason it's not going to go through, or during the time that I'm waiting, can I work? What is my status during that before all these decisions are made?
Great question. While the case is pending, there is no lawful status for that person. So they are just having a receipt notice and proof that they've got a pending case, which may sometimes, under prosecutorial discretion, be enough to avoid being arrested by immigration. So let's say then at the end of this 20-month waiting period, somebody is going to be approved, but they only can get a conditional approval saying you're on our wait list. And we don't know exactly how long that wait list is, but it may be a couple of years. So immigration has been issuing deferred action letters saying you're getting deferred action because you are a victim of crime with a bona fide case. At this point, you may now apply for a work permit. So if I had the consultation today, maybe if everything went perfectly, 2.5 years from now, this person is getting a one-year work permit.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about what it's like to be an undocumented immigrant in this region. We're talking with Helen Tarokich, North Carolina Board Certified Immigration Law Specialist, and Edelmira Segovia, Director of Centro Hispano at UNCW. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. In just a moment, we're going to talk to Dan from Wilmington, but first I want to get to this email. Justin writes, as a former student, I got to work with and study with students from all Hispanic Latino backgrounds and all statuses. I just would like to thank Centro Hispano and Dr. Segovia for not only providing a wonderful place for us to all work together and for being such a wonderful mentor to people with all different life situations. You're truly an inspiration.
Thanks so much.
All right, Dan from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a retired school counselor in the area. And just a quick success story, I had a student who was recently graduated from college, and she went to local high school, and she was a great student, you know, straight-A student, and she ended up getting almost a full scholarship at a private college. And so I would encourage students to consider that, because sometimes they have funds that maybe a public university doesn't, or a public school. She ended up getting almost a full scholarship. In this case, it was Salem and Winston-Salem, and then she got some money from an organization called the Tomorrow Fund in Raleigh. And so anyway, she graduated from college just last year and is now teaching in North Carolina. So I just wanted to say that it can be done. And in her case, she was a great student and someone who really persevered.
That's a really hopeful story. Thank you so much for your call, Dan. Edelmiro Segovia, what are some of the barriers to assimilation, both on campus as a student and here in the community at large? Why is it not so easy sometimes for people from cultures who are so different from this North Carolina, this American culture, to come here?
Let's go back to the question you asked earlier. Who are the students? The majority of our students are going to be Americans, very much born and raised right here at home. A small percentage of our students are going to be the ones that actually have lived the immigration or the immigrants experience. The bulk of our students, though, they may have, I refer to them as pseudo-immigrants or virtual immigrants, but they haven't. They are living through the experiences of their families. But let's keep in mind that the bulk of them are coming from very humble beginnings, very humble homes, families who are, again, may have started their lives here in North Carolina from the agricultural industry, moving on to tourism, moving on to some constructions, some technical skills now. These students are now on our campuses. Some of the barriers are going to go back to that culture of college, that they were not only the translators for their families. They were actually taking adult and grown-up roles in those families in terms of responsibility. So the experiences that they bring forth to our campuses are going to be very different from the experiences of the majority of our population. Mind you that we also, as a selective institution and with the rankings that we have, with that also comes the incomes of our typical UNCW student. Now, this is not everybody, but the bulk of our students are coming in from a middle income to a higher income population with parents who are college educated. Again, that is not everyone, but that is the bulk of our population. They are coming in with study abroad experiences. They're coming in with a load of advanced placement classes, if not already college classes.
Can you talk just a little bit about how that affects a student's perception of him or herself? Like, why, not just not having the experience, but is there any shame associated? Not that there should be, but is there sometimes just embarrassment getting into the larger student population because maybe that student's parents didn't go to college or don't have the same resources?
Sure. And I think that again, is a very personal thing. We have extremely strong students. We actually did a study as part of my dissertation looking at students who are succeeding in this predominantly white institution. We are a PWI, a selective PWI. And so there's a plethora of studies done on the dropouts. The why are students dropping out? We flipped that and we looked at what are successful students doing at a selective PWI. And so we looked at and realized that the students who are very successful, we have more than 50% of our population at a 3.0 or better GPA. Those students have a high rate of pride in their heritage. They are, if not moving towards being bilingual, they're trying to be bilingual. Mind you that they were raised and born here in North Carolina. So in schools, you're going to speak Spanish. I mean, English, you may speak a little bit of Spanish at home, but just listening to it, you're not going to be proficient in writing or reading it. So they're making strides to be fully bilingual, maybe have their first study abroad experience back to that country that we've heard so much about from our parents' trip or from our parents' experience. So our students are very much proud of that heritage. And I think that is also part of the role of Centro Hispano, in that even though you may have a student who is Latino or Hispanic, because we are in North Carolina and because our student, our school system is in English, et cetera, may not have lived their Hispanic culture to the extent that we wish they had. They may have been the only Latino or Hispanic student in that advanced placement class, or they may have been just a handful of Hispanics in that graduating class. Now, when they come on to UNCW and particularly to the family of Centro Hispano, they are among peers who have achieved at that high level of merit and academic achievement. Alongside with them, for the first time, they find themselves among, like I mentioned, we have close roughly 1,000 students who have self-identified as Hispanic Latino. They're taking their own initiatives. They're creating their own student organizations. It is their initiative, that of going out into the public schools to motivate younger generations. And they don't just go to speak with the younger generations of Latino, Hispanic kids in eighth, seventh, and eighth grade, or younger or older. They talk to the entire school. They are reaching out to entire classes. Our most recent student organization has a focus on dance, Ritmo Latino. You may have seen them at the local festivals. That is a very diverse organization, obviously very proud of their heritage, and bringing along our North Carolina peers who have are just learning about the Latino Hispanic culture, who just have a love of dance or have a love of that Spanish language.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Edelmira Segova, director of Centro Hispano at UNCW, and Helen Tarokich, North Carolina Board Certified Immigration Law Specialist. And we have an email from Christopher. He writes, "I'm a former alumni from UNCW and Centro Hispano. I want to congratulate publicly the hard work that Centro Hispano has done in our local community, along with being recognized by President Barack Obama at the White House. Due to their support, I was able to graduate and now serve as a Peace Corps volunteer in China." Thank you so much for that email, Christopher. And I want to talk a little bit more about how the predominantly white community can reach across some of these perceived obstacles and help the assimilation process. Helen Tarokich, you're doing some work with the League of Women Voters, which is a separate issue. But are there ways that just people in the community can reach out a little bit more and make people feel more at home and less like aliens in their own hometown?
There are so many things that people can do, and I've been so lucky in my career to witness a lot of that happening. We have many people who actually bring potential clients to our office. They are a source of comfort and a source of information to say to them that you can have a conversation that is confidential and protected, and it's time for you to tell your story and see what can be done. And that moment would never happen if we didn't have so many people from the community who are trying to help their friends and neighbors. We've had one of the most touching stories I had was an American who brought in an immigrant because that person had been caring for her father, who was a veteran of two different wars, and he cared for that man so much that he really looked at him as a son. And it was that incredible relationship and helpfulness that brought that person to our office for assistance, and just giving them a safe place can be critical.
Just giving them a safe place. Thank you so much for joining us today, Edelmira Segovia, Helen Tarokich. Thanks to all of you who called and emailed to join the conversation. Join us next week for Coastline when we talk with Paul Wilkes about the second to last chapter of your life and why he says service should be part of it. That's next Wednesday, January 20th at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of today's show, look for it on our website at whqr.org or subscribe to the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.